Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Stephen Reid podcast. Today we're joined by Michael Fleming and we're talking about things like ethics, veganism and football coaching. I hope you enjoy. Michael.
Hey.
Hi Michael, how are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. You?
Very good, thank you. Cracking. Welcome to the boat.
You said wonderful boat.
This is the first time you've been on a boat.
A ship.
Yeah, we were just discussing before the episode today, my boat got called a ship, and so I'm definitely going to roll with that from now on. I'm really glad to have you in the podcast studio because you're actually the first guest who's been recommended to me by someone else. So I sought you out and got you on the podcast. But actually, it's been quite a while since I've seen you. I think it's been probably about at least 3 or 4 years, I think.
Yeah, I can't remember. Did I? Apologies if I did see you at some point, like since we left school.
I think we met at the pub once when Will decided to get us all together.
Yeah.
But apart from that, I hadn't really seen you since school. And even at school, I mean, we hang out a few times, but I didn't particularly know you all that well, really.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've got a lot of catching up to do, I think, on today's podcast.
That's
so
for sure.
I'm gonna bombard you with loads of questions and find out all that's been going on in your life, and we'll see where it goes. But I'll start off by trying to introduce you and your past, and you can correct me if you're wrong.
Yeah, no problems.
So obviously, went to school in sixth form with us. Meanwhile, during that time, you were in a band with Will and Ben and a few other mates while you were at school, right? You play piano and
guitar.
I found out you actually play piano is it piano or guitar to grade 8 level?
Piano. I don't think I did grades with guitar.
You didn't.
Hopefully I can remember how to play the piano at all, like since uni.
Seriously?
I can remember, but like obviously it won't be as like. It's good because I didn't really play it during while I was at uni or anything.
Do you still play either of those instruments now?
Yeah, I play guitar and then occasionally I will plonk about on a piano for a bit.
Okay. Do you have a piano at your home or?
Yeah, I've got a piano at home at the moment, but I'm now at home for the first time in a little while. So.
Because you went to uni after school and studied accounting.
Yeah.
And spent 3 years doing accounting and then went on and spent some time doing teacher training. What was the thing that stopped you and turned you around and made you go into accounting, because that's what you're doing right now, isn't it?
Well I think it was mostly just that I thought I'd give teaching a shot and thought I wanted to do that, and then I think decided that wasn't for me about halfway through the program. So in terms of reasons for that, God, I think I've probably blanked out of my memory.
Did you have reasons initially why you thought teaching was for you?
Yeah. So I thought teaching would be for me because I thought it'd be varied. You obviously deal with different situations every day in a classroom. I thought it'd be sort of, to some extent fulfilling, working with people. I just like the idea of, because I was going to be a maths teacher as well.
Okay.
So, I liked maths and, thought dealing with all of that stuff.
Sure.
It'd be quite cool.
What do you enjoy about maths? Because it's something that
a lot of
people, myself included, aren't particularly that keen on. Whether you're good at it or not, I think a lot of people still don't enjoy doing it.
Yeah. I'm not even sure I enjoyed it that much in school, but enjoyed it more like a little afterwards. I just sort of like logical problem solving. Which makes me sound like as boring a human being as possible.
And something I've noticed as well is actually there's quite a common theme between people who are good at maths or enjoy maths and instruments.
Yeah, that's definitely something a lot of people say. I think that's definitely true.
What is it about that that transitions between the two? I don't really know because I've never been particularly great at either of them.
I think it's probably that both of them do. I know people don't tend to associate music with logic, but I think to some extent that's true. Definitely if you're into writing music or stuff like that, there's definitely a lot of logic in, you know, both playing an instrument, writing music, because you are to some extent working within musical rules. Whether or not you're like aware of the rules, music, you know, you obviously know that music sounds terrible when you just, if you just plonked your hand on a keyboard, you'd know it wouldn't produce a good sound. So like, you know, there are certain rules that are essentially followed that makes music either sound like palatable or rubbish. I think it's sort of working within the confines of that.
And is it to do with like patterns and the intervals in between?
Yeah, exactly. So like, I don't know, I won't get technical, but yeah, certain intervals between notes in accordance with other ones will sound, yeah, good, and others, like if you play two notes right next to each other, that probably won't produce a very nice sound on its own, like others don't sound so pleasant, kind of thing.
So I know when you played in your band at school, that was, correct me if I'm wrong, that was metal, was it?
Yeah, well, I think we started off metal, and then I think we were always in that kind of area, and kind of, yeah, slightly changed styles a bit.
And you played guitar at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Will played keys.
Yeah.
And Ben played bass, is that right? Or did Ben play guitar as well?
Yeah, so again, we kind of shifted roles a bit, because I think first Will was keys, and then he did bass at some point, and I don't think he did guitar, or did he? No, yeah, so, and then, yeah, I think Ben was mostly guitar, because we'd have sort of two guitars, I think most of the time.
Do you associate yourself with any other bands? Have you played in any others since
then? I've not really been playing since then, like, to be honest, I've not done so much music since finishing school. Not really picked up anything in that regard.
So you studied in Bristol, right? How was your time there? Because we've spent a bit of time in Bristol, myself and Will, just going back and forth between staying with our mate Guy and going out to club nights and stuff. And we certainly enjoyed it as a city. And
Bristol's really cool. Like tons of places to go. Just a really nice sort of, you know, fairly sort of pretty city, pretty open, kind of, you know, large enough that there's plenty to do, not so large that you feel trapped, kind of thing. I think, well, more than anything, it's just sort of the people you meet at uni, I think, that make that make that cool. You know,
were you part of any societies or any clubs or anything at uni?
Not really, to be honest. I sort of, you know, preferred to sort of do my own thing.
Which is?
Well, I'm interested in football a lot, so I like to, as in, I didn't really play much football because I'm very bad at that, but I like football tactics a lot, so I spend a lot of time.
This is something that Will told me about a couple of weeks ago, and I had absolutely no idea.
Yeah, yeah.
So like you say, I didn't remember you playing football at school.
Yeah, rubbish at playing.
But coaching something you were interested in or are interested in?
Yeah, I'm interested in, still looking to sort of get started on. But I think that, you know, that mostly comes from a place of finding football tactics really interesting. You know, sort of like how a team will play against another team, the kind of weight, just the sort of, well, one styles that teams will use and the way that their players will interact with each other to sort of, you know, hopefully produce good outcomes on a field. I find all that quite cool.
So have you been doing any coaching so far, or is it just...
No, not coaching. I'm looking for clubs at the moment. I've just sort of been settling in with my new job over the last couple of months. So I'm sort of looking to get started at that now. So again, most of the football-related stuff I've done has sort of been, you know, watching matches and looking at the tactics used.
What is it specifically then about football? Because obviously you can go into the tactics of any sport, right? Is there something different about football tactics than, say, rugby or...
That's a good question.
Hockey or something like that?
I mean, I can't say that I've looked into the other sports, but clearly there was something I found more interesting about football. If I were to guess, I'd say... Well, I mean, hockey's... I think I like the complexity of football, because if you, say, compare it to hockey, there are more players on a football pitch than a hockey pitch. Therefore, you've sort of got... Because in terms of tactics, it's largely about the interactions between the players, both on your team and on the other team. So if you've got 11v11, that's sort of like a few tiers of complexity greater than, I don't know how many people play in a hockey team.
I Don't either, really, to be honest.
Yeah, but if I compared it to something like basketball, that's five. Is it five? I don't know.
It's definitely a lot fewer than.
Yeah, so I think that's what I find interesting about football. And if I'd compare it to something like rugby, I think the fact that the ball can go forwards means I reckon you get more complexity tactically in football than in rugby. I mean, I think rugby is a complex sport and you've obviously got more players. Is it something like 15, 16? Again, I really don't know much
15,
about sports other than football.
I think.
Yeah.
This is showing up on my lack of knowledge now in all the sports.
Well, it's showing up mine as well. Like, football's the only one I know anything about. And even that, you know.
Well, I thought for a long time that football was a fairly simple sport. And it's only over the last year or so when I've been paying a bit more attention to it and we've been doing fantasy football and I've been following different players and trying to figure out which team, you know, how to make the best, highest scoring team.
Yeah.
Each week or over the period of the football season. And I never realised, actually, you know, when they're breaking down all of the football nonsense at the end of a game and they go on and talk about it for ages, I thought, how on earth can you do that? Surely it's just as simple as passing the ball around well enough and getting it in the goal, right?
The funny thing is that normally when people on TV break down a football match, they're normally doing it really badly. Like, especially, I think Sky Sports aren't so bad, but BBC are terrible at least. Like, you know, they'll often sort of point out patterns that aren't really there or harp on about old cliches that aren't really true. But yeah, I think the reason why people think football is a simple game is that it's got simple rules. Like, you know, the actual rule, because if you look at rugby, I'd say the rules are a little more complex. Mm. You've got a few more complications. Yeah. It's a bit harder to understand kind of thing. With football, it's dead easy to play. You know that you're essentially kicking the ball to other people and trying to kick the ball into the opposition goal. Like, you've got a couple of little things like the offside rule, but nothing really that complicated. So I think in terms of its rules, it's a complicated game. But I mean, a simple game.
So
I think that's probably where that comes
from. If you're not someone who's played football then, how on earth do you get into football coaching and getting into all of that tactics? What's the process you go through to get to that stage?
That's a good question. I've no idea. I don't know. Well, I think, yeah, I think I sort of started playing football, like, as in, you know, sort of the first time I ever sort of kicked a ball was into secondary school. And at that point, it's way too late to get any good at it. Mm. But at that point, you know, I'd enjoy watching teams. So, you know, I'd really enjoy the sport without actually being good at playing it.
And
so
you're a United supporter.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Sure, that'd be contentious. Do you support a team?
I'm actually a neutral. Yeah. I used to be a United supporter when I was much younger. Yeah. And that's very much because my grandfather was and still is sort of a Man United supporter.
Yeah.
But we were never really that passionate about the club. And it was pretty much just because Ryan Giggs played for them.
Yeah.
And being both Welsh, he was sort of our, you know, biggest asset really in the Welsh football team. You know, I think at the time he was the only football player that played in the Premier League, and the rest played maybe in the Championship, but mostly played in Division 1 and Division 2.
Yeah.
So before then, you know, he was the icon and the star, and we supported the national team more than the United.
Uh-huh.
But since Giggs left and, you know, I kind of lost interest in football in general, I supported maybe Cardiff and Swansea as they've done sort of good and bad, but it's more just followed really.
Yeah.
And then I realised that I don't really have any good enough reasons to be associated with them other than being, you know, nationally from Wales.
But, yeah, it's weird, the whole supporting football teams thing. Like, there's no real reason to pick a team, and I think for most people they don't pick a team, right? You know, you sort of probably at a fairly young age it just becomes a fact you support this team, and then, you know, before long you've built up enough of an allegiance that there was no real reason. It's just how it is.
And I think a lot of people get it from families too, right?
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Very much the same.
That's probably
how
they get it
from
your age.
Mine, right? What strikes me as baffling, though, with that in mind, is the fact that people are so overly passionate and tribalistic about those clubs. When, as you say, they don't have a strong enough, they don't have a very strong motive to be a fan of them anyway, right?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose on some level, like, sports is there so that you can play tribes. Like, I think that's kind of the root of sports. Like, I think I heard the fact that humans are the only animal that engages in, like, play between groups. So, like, no other animal engages in something equivalent to a sport between groups. Like, they have, like, you know how dogs will play. They'll play one-on-one, but humans are the only ones that do it between groups. And I think the fact that we do that is at root some kind of an evolutionary mechanism to prepare ourselves for probably something like tribal warfare.
Right. So you think that's fairly innate in
us? I think that's fairly innate that we want to play sports. Like, you know, we are tribal creatures. We kind of know that.
Yeah.
Where was I going with that? So I think in some level it makes sense that people are so passionate about their team. I obviously think it's bad because, like, I think for most people, you know, it goes so far. Like, people aren't honestly hateful of people of other that support other teams, but you do get some people obviously that take that too far. And I don't think it can be disputed that you're taking it too far if you're, like, you know, hateful to someone on the basis of what team they support. Or,
and I've struggled for a long time actually between the different levels of patriotism, usually when it comes to like the Olympics or something. And it's very similar to football in that sense, that at what stage does being patriotic and, you know, supporting your country, wanting them to do well, become negative in the sense that you want other countries to do badly, maybe because they're a certain country, not just because they're other competitors, right? It's a very strange, blurry line, I think, in my head at least.
No, yeah, agreed. Because I'd say, like, the bit of... It's kind of like the pros and cons of tribalism. Like, because I'd say the pros of tribalism are caring about your in-group. Like, so as in caring about your tribe. Like, because that's what produces, I'd say, some of the best things about humanity. Like, you know, love, care for the people you're close to. You know, anything that motivates people to do something that isn't for themselves, I think, is kind of a function of tribalism. But then you also get some of the worst of humanity, you know, mobs, hatred.
Yeah, war, like you say.
Well, even things like, I mean, racism isn't, well, it's kind of inherently tribal. You know, I think racism will come from a place of wanting to, because often interacting with other tribes would mean, you know, back in our longest evolutionary period would mean the transmittance of diseases between groups. The most dramatic example is like when people came from England to America, like I think it was about 90% of the Native Americans died as a result of disease.
Wow. Not even just warfare.
I'm sure warfare is a big element, but, you know, I think what's looked over is that the overwhelming majority was just that we had loads of diseases from the European continent that, because we had animals that we interacted with and Native Americans didn't.
And we were resistant to a lot of stuff too, right?
Yeah, and because of the animals, we were resistant to the diseases because we've been around animals and they're transmitters of disease, and because they hadn't really domesticated animals in North America, or America full stop, they were susceptible to all the diseases we were resilient to, and they didn't have many going the other way, so we didn't get massive deaths and sickness
because
we were resistant to stuff.
It makes a lot of sense. So, yeah. It's something I never knew, actually.
Yeah.
So, yeah, point of that all being that I think, yeah, that's one of the reasons why tribalism brings out some of the worst in people too, hatred of the other tribe.
Would you class yourself as someone that's particularly patriotic or even a passionate supporter of, say, United, or are you tribalistic?
Patriotism, I'd say I'm virtually not at all. It's never sort of resonated with me. It's interesting when you talk to people because, you know, you often do get this kind of binary effect where people are either resonates really deeply with them or not at all. As a United supporter, a bit more. I think partially because that's just sort of fun. Like, it's fun playing the tribal game and, you know, taking the piss out of a mate who... Can I swear on?
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
taking the piss out of a mate who's team loses.
If it's used in the right situation, then swearing is definitely enhances the conversation, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. Just thought I'd check the house rules.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it's fun to play the game. In terms of how much I'm always following United, as in always seeing how they do and trying to watch as many games as I can, but... How much allegiance I feel for me depends strongly on how well they're playing. So, and particularly how well they're being employed tactically, because that's ultimately the bit of football I find really interesting. So, like, when it hasn't happened much in recent seasons. I don't know how much you follow football, but United have dropped off a lot since Ferguson left.
Certainly have in this current season, actually, with Mourinho.
Yeah.
His sort of downfall, and he's left recently, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Did he get fired or...
Yeah, he got fired. and I was very happy about that, because we were playing horrible football. And I
never liked him anyway.
No, I really dislike him as a human being, because he constantly sort of throws his players under the bus.
Yeah. He was really rude to a physio as well.
Yeah. That was Ava Camara at Chelsea.
And she was just doing her job, and he was really rude about her.
No, he's not a good human being. And he has an ego the size of a house. Like,
I have been very tribalistic about the fact that I am a physio, and I don't like him being rude to my physios.
No, fair enough. I'll support anything going against Jose Mourinho. That works for me.
Well, there you go. Well, we're on the same side on that.
Yeah,
one,
exactly. In tribal identity.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I think you can find similarities and things to be tribalistic about with almost nearly everyone, really, because you know, at a basic level, we are. I think it's genetically we are like 99.8%. You know, the same as one another. You know, if you take someone from Ghana or Brazil or Australia, I think, you know, our similarities run so deep that you know, what we're having differences on are like splitting hairs. You know, it's literally the smallest things that we're dividing ourselves upon.
No, I couldn't agree more. Like, I think that represents, you know, sort of almost like the best hope for humanity coming together as a whole. Like, it's just the fact we are all way more similar than we are different. Like, obviously, we're all humans. Like, as you say, we share, you know, 99.9, I don't know how many nines, percent of our DNA with each other. Like, it'd be ridiculous to suggest otherwise. So, like, I do think that definitely represents sort of the best of humanity, is bringing out, realizing we're all kind of the same tribe. And then you can get those effects of, you know, the positive aspects of tribalism. Because, you know, if we weren't tribalistic at all, I think that's kind of the only reason we, from an evolutionary standpoint, have morals, right? Because, you know, the way evolution works is obviously, like, we function only to propagate our genes on the level of evolution, because that's the only reason anything continues to exist. So, like, if we weren't tribal, you know, if we didn't work with other people, we would feel, emotionally at least, no reason to better the life of anyone else. Or, you know,
be very selfish existence.
Well, I mean you might be able to, you know, suppose we were intelligent beings, you might be able to use logic or something to say, I don't actually feel anything like compassion or love, but I should do something good for someone else. But you'd never feel that emotion. And emotion's a much stronger driver of action, I think, than you know, thought is.
That's a really interesting point, though, because I feel that there's something opposing to that, though.
Yeah.
That actually, often we don't do good because we want it to benefit other people.
Yeah.
I think innately, often we do good things because it benefits us.
Oh yeah, I totally agree.
And
totally true.
And not our tribe and our family or friends, but actually just physically and personally, just I, you know, me. And actually, whether that is because it directly means that some, you know, if you do a good turn for someone who's got a skill that it could benefit you, you know, maybe there's deeper reasons for doing that good thing, or maybe it's because it's as superficial as the fact that it just makes you feel good.
Yeah,
I think it's an interesting point of whether we really do good things for purely altruistic reasons, or whether it's because there are benefits to us. I'm not sure. It's probably on a sliding scale.
Yeah,
sure,
but I would say it's like, you know, 95%, if not more, what you suggested, people doing good things for their own good, whether they know it or not, whether they think they do it or not. Like, again, this is why I sort of spoke about the root of tribalism and why the good aspects of that are, you know, maybe the only reason we ever do anything nice. Because, like, if we do something nice because it makes us feel good, that probably beats never doing anything nice.
Yeah, it's still positive,
isn't
it?
Yeah, it's a positive outcome.
Helping someone in some way.
But yeah, I think people very rarely do good things for selfless reasons. Because I just don't think we're really wired to, as in...
No. Yeah. But going back to the whole patriotism and nationalism aspect of being in a tribe.
Yeah.
I think it's a really interesting push that's gone on in our lifetime and just before us as well, that I don't think any longer we can say that there is such a thing as a Briton or someone who's, the movement of people across the world has been so free-flowing that we've got to a stage where, what is it that defines you being from Briton? At the end of the day, it's harder to pinpoint it with Briton, but at least in Europe, and the rest of the world, these are just lines drawn on a map, right? At the end of the day, there's no physical difference between stepping over the line between Wales and England, right?
Yeah. I think this is a topic I've not thought very much about, but I know is like a much bigger one than I can sort of do justice to in any sense. But like, I do think I was going to say, and I've forgotten it.
Well, going back then to the football stuff, because again, that's something that's still quite interests me. Yeah. And I
the other topic that interests me as well, I just don't feel like I know much about it.
That's fair enough. Yeah. Well, I was going to say earlier that one of the benefits to being a neutral is actually you can enjoy a football game whether anyone wins or loses. Yeah. And I've really benefited from that. And I think the sport definitely benefits from that, because you're not then just there for the benefit of a team. You're there for the sport itself and the pure pleasure of watching the sport, right?
Mm. Yeah, I'd say that's the main reason I watch football. Like, again, because I think in part because I'm interested in it. I at the end of the day, what I really want to see is something like beautiful football. I want to see, and I don't mean like beautiful in terms of superficial like frills that aren't effective. I mean, I want to see really effective football. That's what I really like to see. Like from a tactical standpoint, from the standpoint of individuals doing really impressive things. Like,
what team would you say does that really well or demonstrates those types of qualities?
Well, you have differentiation between, I mean, I think the best player in the world and of all time by a long shot is I think it's Lionel Messi, and like by a long shot. So if you want to see an individual do ridiculous things with a football, just on the level of pure sportsmanship and just impressive ability, like watch Lionel Messi play for Barcelona. Like that's the only thing you need to do, because you're watching like one of the best footballer of all time, in my opinion, in his prime.
And a lot of people would agree with you. He's one of the most favoured footballers in thing. When people are asked who's the best footballer of all time, I think quite often they mention him. In terms of living footballers or currently active footballers, and he's been playing for quite a long time as well. And I think
he's 30 now,
but at the top of his game for quite a long time too. Yeah. Which is quite clearly down to his vegan diet, obviously.
Yeah, no doubt.
There's not actually that many vegan footballers, and I know there's
Bellerin, I think, playing for Arsenal.
Who else? What's his name? Oh, bloody forgotten now. He plays for Man City. Never mind. It'll come back to me. But there is also a purely vegan football team. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I've not heard of it. No.
They're in League Two, I think, and they're called Forest Green Rovers, which I think is fairly ironic.
No, I've heard of the team.
They're a green team. Uh-huh. And I went and watched them, actually, not this year, but the year before on Boxing Day, I think, or New Year's Day, and they lost, unfortunately.
Sad.
Which has nothing to do, obviously, with their vegan diet.
Was it just they were robbed?
Yeah, they were robbed.
The ref was a meat-eating scumbag.
He was.
Who, dished out a red card unfairly. And
the players themselves aren't vegan. They don't have to convert themselves, but they are signed into a contract that when they're at the ground or when they're training, that they have to eat and subscribe to a vegan diet, and they have loads of vegan food at the ground. It was purely vegan food. And
has the club always been that way? Why did they shift?
There's one of the businessmen, or the businessman who bought the club, is vegan, but he's also very passionate about the environment, and he his business is a renewable, sustainable energy.
Yeah.
So he comes from that kind of motivation anyway. Mm-hmm. And so I think he took over the club, and
a reason why he picked the team called Forest Green.
Possibly, like, yeah.
I think that's probably not coincidence.
They weren't doing very well financially for a while, and he was one of the, I think he is fairly local anyway. And mm-hmm. so he, being one of the richest men in the area, probably picked it up and wanted to plough a load of money in, but on certain terms. But being in Veganuary at the moment, I think the growth of the whole thing has been huge.
Yeah.
Huge recently. I don't know how...
I've not heard of Veganuary, actually.
Have you not?
No.
Oh,
but,
goodness.
You know, I live under a rock, so...
Do you? Yeah. What, do you use social media or...
No, I do use social media, but I'm good at not hearing about things.
Okay. Well, let me educate you then.
Yeah, go on.
And I want to hear your viewpoint on it too, because I don't know if you've put much thought into it, but it's something that a lot of people have fairly strong opinions of.
Yeah, of course.
Whether they've spent any time thinking.
No, I've got some thoughts on it.
But, okay. Yeah. Well, every January for the last 3 or 4 years, there has been a scheme like Stoptober, or like Dry January, or November, those types of things, where Veganuary is the month where people sign up for a month to be vegan, and with the idea that, you know, they try it for a month and they get loads of support, and then eventually they may well stay vegan for the long run. And a couple of years ago, I think 3 years ago when it first started, there was 3,000 people sign up to it. Mm-hmm. And then this year, there was 300,000 people sign up to it.
Okay, that's a big deal.
And in the space of 2 years, there was a 700% increase in the amount of vegans in the UK.
Yeah.
And it's sort of the biggest growing diet. And actually,
it's growing a lot. But
There's a lot of money in it as well at the moment. That a lot of companies use Veganuary to bring out lots of vegan products.
Yeah.
And again, going back to what we were saying earlier, that's probably not because they're that passionate about veganism, but probably because they want to benefit themselves.
Of course.
But at the same time, it's bloody brilliant for anyone that eats vegan food, because it's just getting easier and easier.
Yeah.
But I've been vegan for 2 years.
Yeah.
And it's a word that's been dropped a couple of times in the podcast, but this is the first time I've ever properly spoken about it with someone in this format. So I'm curious, because I've never talked to you about it. What are your feelings on the whole movement or the whole ethos behind it?
I mean, I've got no real feelings on the movement, to be honest. So there's kind of quite a lot to unpack with this topic. So I'd say I can answer the question as to why I'm not vegan or vegetarian. So this kind of comes down to a question of ethics and, you know, morality. Mm. And I think I'm a little more robotic in the way I view morality. So, you know, the way, I won't go too technical, but the way I sort of view morality is something like, you know, you should, essentially something like you should maximize good things and minimize bad things.
Mm.
As like quite mechanistic. And, I'm quite mechanistic in the way I apply that. So, the reason I'm not vegetarian comes down to a pretty simple question, which is like, if I was asked the question of whether I could live for 2 years or not live at all, I would select to live for 2 years, assuming that I had an overall positive life. Right. So assuming that I had more good things than bad things in my life, I'd elect to live for 2 years.
If you had a good enough quality of life.
Yeah, if I had a good enough quality of life that I was like above something like zero. So essentially if the quality of my, again, I won't go into religion or anything, but I'm generally would consider that upon my death, I'd probably imagine there will be nothing, like I will not continue to exist. Mm-hmm. But I'll leave that topic for now.
So bear with that in mind.
Yeah, so with that in mind, if I consider that my life would be better than not living, like it'd be better than just nothing, then I would elect to live for 2 years rather than none. And when I apply that to something like farms, I'd say, well, the reason that a cow's life, say, let's say a cow, because I think you can make the best case of for a cow having a positive life. Again, we'll get into that in a bit. But if I'm a cow and I'm going to have a positive life overall, I'd rather live than not live. And if I want to live, the only way I get to live is for somebody to pay to eat me at the end of my life, essentially. Like, there's no reason farmers would breed the cows if they were not eventually used for commercial purposes. Again, we're kind of onto the doing good things, but not for the good thing.
So is that based on the fact that they are currently alive, or is that the fact that they were given the opportunity to even exist in the first place?
Yeah, so it's the latter. So it's, yeah, because... I view very controversially, I'd say the outcome of death and of never having lived is the same, right? So if I was never born or if I died tomorrow, the outcome's the same, like assuming there's no religion involved. You know, there's just nothing for me. I don't exist. There's not even a me. So if you view it through that lens, I think it's valid to pose the question of, is it better to live for no time or for 2 years at a positive life?
Yeah.
The other thing I'd say to the contrary is, not to the contrary, but taking the other angle of supposing the lives that currently exist. So suppose I'm a cow now in a field. I've lived for, I don't know how long cows live for actually, but suppose I've lived for half a year and I'm going to live for a year in total. So I've got half a year of my life left to run.
But bearing in mind, they usually live for, I think it's upwards of about 20 years. Although that's their lifespan is up to about 20 years. But okay, often this is where my knowledge falls down, but I believe often they're slaughtered within the first 2 to 3 or 5 years of their life, I believe.
Yeah, no, I don't know anything about the actual, everything I'm speaking about does not come from a place of actual research or knowledge.
Yeah.
Well, some knowledge, but none that I've sort of looked into myself. So, where was I?
It's better to live a short life.
So I was going to talk about, so suppose I'm a cow alive now, and suppose tomorrow nobody ate meat anymore, like eating meat just stopped being a thing. What would happen to all the cows then is the farmers would go, it's no longer financially feasible to continue keeping you alive. It's unlikely the society would pick up the burden of looking after all the cows. So chances are the overwhelming majority would be slaughtered tomorrow. So even if I leave aside the hypothetical of, is not living the same as dying, it's still true that for a cow alive today, if there were nobody eating meat, that cow would die tomorrow in all likelihood, rather than die however many years left it had, or days.
That is if we were all to go vegan tomorrow, right?
So I'm using the point to illustrate, I think I'm just using it to illustrate the equivalence between, like, if there's nobody that wants to eat meat, the animal doesn't live. I think that's kind of the point I'm trying to make.
So let me ask you then, how you feel if we take it into maybe a similar human example. Yeah. Uh-huh. So take it back couple hundred years ago when African Americans were wrongly taken out of Africa, shipped over to America and New Europe and Britain and enslaved and made to work in fields, kept in poor conditions, abused, maybe raped, physically and verbally insulted or assaulted.
Yeah.
Is it then fair to say that you should carry on with that argument that you've used? And I'm not saying that... this is a question, really.
Yeah.
Is it fair to say then that you should carry on breeding and, growing the population of slaves because... Mm-hmm. For their benefit of living in those poor conditions, which is the case for most farmed animals, because it's not financially feasible these days for farmers to keep cows in an open field.
Yeah, I'll push back on that point a bit. I'll answer your initial question first and then I'll talk about that. So first I'll talk about the point of, essentially the comparison to slavery. So I think there are two reasons why I don't think the analogy works. One would be, my first point actually is the bit I was going to talk about later, so I'll leave that for now. But the second point, no, sorry, no, it's not. I No, I had 3 points and then had to axe one of them. Yeah, so one... Okay, first point is... Whereas if there's no demand for meat, I think it's overwhelmingly likely cows, say, die tomorrow. The same is not true in the case of, an African population of slaves. Like, clearly the amount of black people currently alive in the world today hasn't gone down as a result of the non-existence of slavery, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's the argument regarding, you know, for this thing to live at all, it has to be, you know, in poor conditions that serve someone else, isn't true for the black population, right? Because obviously there are more black people today than there were back then, and there's no slavery. So I think that's probably the key way in which it breaks down. I think the second thing I was going to bring up is, this is related to the point I'll make in a sec, but there's a difference between being enslaved and in bad conditions as a human than as an animal. Simply because as a human, you're more aware of your poor quality of life and of the fact that your freedom is, you know, infringed in a way that I think is impossible to argue is not something that should happen. Whereas for an animal, you're not self-aware in the sense that you can be aware of that. A cow might have a worse quality of life in a, you know, in whatever conditions it's kept than in free in a field, say. Although I'm not entirely sure that's true, but well, I'll get onto that in a sec. But in both cases, it's not aware of its freedom or lack thereof, or of the life it could have otherwise. And I think that has a strong negative impact on the situation in the case of slavery. But
So just to clarify, so that I'm following you.
Sorry, I don't think I've made myself very clear on that point.
You're implying that a cow, if it was, say, trapped in a factory, it wouldn't be aware of the fact that it is suffering a poor quality of life because it doesn't know anything other than that.
Well, no, it would be aware that it's suffering a poor quality of life insofar as it feels pain, right? What it wouldn't be aware of is that there was the possibility of a much better life, if that makes sense.
Okay.
So I'm not saying it feels the same amount of pain in the case of you're in a factory even versus you're in a field. I am saying it's at least not aware of the fact that the field, like if it's in a factory, it's not aware of the fact that it could have had a better life. I think to be honest, I think that's a fairly kind of peripheral point that I probably won't get too hung up on.
Okay.
So I'll get onto the other point I was going to make about essentially comparing the quality of a slave's existence versus the quality of a cow's one. I'll just talk about the quality of cow's ones. So, to my not like, I can't so much speak for myself, but I'll keep it anonymous for the sake of, because I don't know whether the relevant person would want to be named or anything. But you know, someone I know, is, you know, works on farms quite regularly and has regular contact with farm animals, and to their knowledge and, you know, to their awareness, the animals on farms, with the possible exception of chickens, have pretty good quality lives. You could say maybe they have less good lives than if they lived in total freedom. And I don't really know the specifics, so I can't really debate on that. But at least in the UK, certainly things like cows are living, for the most part, very good lives. I think they are in fields. I know in the US, factory farming is much more dodgy. In the UK, we have, again, I'm taking this secondhand from sort of my source on the topic. Mm. So I can't personally vouch for it. But UK legislation's pretty strict on the fact we need to keep animals in pretty good conditions. US is a lot dodgier, and I think that's where a lot of bad press regarding factory farming comes from. And I think in the US it's probably valid. Like, I think if I were to live in the US, I'd probably have to be at least vegetarian, because I'm quite mechanistic about the way I view good things and bad things. So if the bad things outweigh the good things for a life, it's actually worse for the life to exist. Like, if you ask me whether I'd rather not live at all or to live for 2 years as a life that was bad, like actually worse than not living, I'd choose to never live. And I think that might be the conundrum you're faced with if you are a cow in the US, right? Definitely the conundrum you're faced with if you're a chicken in the US. In which case, obviously, it's better to not live. At least if you view ethics and morality the way I do, which I grant is quite abstract and cold, I suppose.
Well, I think the thing is with ethics and morals is they're, you know, everyone has their own interpretation of what's good and bad, right?
Yeah.
And there's not necessarily... There are socially acceptable norms of what good and bad are, and that probably goes back to what we were saying earlier with it. That's probably based on the fact that, you know, we want as a society for everyone to benefit in some way, and being, you know, horrible and murderous and thieving to other people is probably quite negative for
in a tribal society. Environment back when we were evolving like that gets you probably killed by your own tribe, like,
so so with that in mind, then recently in the last month there's been a big push towards reducing meat in your diet, not from an ethical standpoint for the welfare of an animal, but for the welfare of the human race and the global environment and the future of the human existence, right? And there are various other contributors like tourism and, you know, traffic and things like that, as well as you know, making clothing and different types of industries that all have negative influences on global warming and the environment. But there was a big study done by Oxford University who said that reducing meat in your diet is the biggest thing that would impact your carbon footprint. And researchers have recently come up in the last month to say that in order to carry on sustaining life on this planet, and because of the scares we have with the global climate change, is to reduce the amount of meat that you consume to the degree that you're eating. I believe it was claimed the size of one burger a week in red meat.
Yeah,
what do you feel then about that in terms of as being maybe for yourself a stronger argument than purely the ethical reasons of whether a cow should live or die, if you see what I mean?
I think that to me is definitely the stronger argument, like as in given my moral standpoint, mm-hmm. which I grant is subjective and, you know, not trying to enforce that on anyone. So environmental concerns I think are valid. Again, not personally looked into the research in any detail, but like, you know, it's obvious that nobody serious disputes that global environmental change is a thing, or whatever you want to call it. Again, I think the evidence is pretty clear that a huge proportion of that is down to mass farming. You do have I think because of the fact I view farming as a good, not just a neutral, due to my moral standpoint, it's morally iffy, because, you know, if it's like, you know, how many fewer cows get to live as a result of us massively downscale farming, is that's a moral trade-off, and I don't know where I fall on that. And that at least in large part comes down to, you know, what will the end game with something like climate change be? Like, I don't really know. And you do hear very varying estimates from, you know, some people suggesting, I don't think the overall majority of people suggest, you know, it's going to have significant effects. But there's a big difference between like living in a very different world 50 years from now, or however long it will take, and between that and the end of the world, right? Like, the end of the world, say, is clearly a much worse outcome than just living in a world where, say, a lot of land is undersea.
Yeah, and likely a lot further away too.
Yeah. So I think in light of that, I can't really answer it with any data. It comes down to the trade-off of, you know, how many fewer animals get to live versus, you know, how much does this impact our world? And, you know, that's definitely not a question I can answer.
Looking ahead then to the future, and maybe coming away from the topic of veganism for now, currently you're working in London, right?
Yeah.
You're traveling back and forth to work as an accountant, are you? Are you doing training at the moment, or employed as an accountant?
Both. So employed as an accountant, and I'm also getting qualified at the end of 3 years. So you know, you're doing work to get qualified and you're also sitting some exams. So,
okay.
Yeah, both.
And then your partner, who, to my knowledge, is still studying at university, is due to graduate in the next, in this year, is it?
Yeah, due to graduate this year, summertime.
So what are your plans going forward? What is it that motivates you, and what are you going forward to do in the next, say, you know, couple of years to five years?
Well, that's a difficult question that I up and down on it a bit. I mean, you know, I'm generally quite motivated by my hobbies. I'd like to get more involved in football. If I can get involved in coaching, that'd be cool. If I could, you know, just to spend more time learning more about it, that'd be cool as well. Again, I just like to dedicate time to whatever my interests are. So that can be, you know, learning about all kinds of random crap. That can be, you know, getting involved in football. I could get involved in music again. So I'm quite open-ended on it. And honestly, I think for some reason over the last few months, there's been a lot of questions in my mind about, you know, what exactly the right way to sort of live your life is. And I've definitely not answered those yet. So I think what it's an open book as it stands. It depends very much on...
What are the kind of questions that come up then when you... Because there's never a correct answer to that.
Yeah,
you know, what is the best way to live a person's life? You mentioned sort of earlier a philosophy that I very much try and live my life by, which is doing as much good and doing as little bad as possible.
Yeah. Right? That's definitely how I view things, like theoretically, ethically. But I think there are some ways in which that sort of, it doesn't break down in real life, but I think human beings are limited, and I think we're limited by two key things when it comes to acting, like, say, morally. One way we're limited is by our emotions and our desires, right? Like, simply put, we're mostly self-interested. Like we were talking about earlier, most of the things we do will be for our own benefit, whether we know it or not. You know, if you agree with that premise, then we're severely limited by that in the extent to which we almost can do good, because we just won't find ourselves doing as much as we can, right? And I think the other constraint we have is on our ability to reason through things, right? Humans are obviously, like, you know, the smartest animal that's ever lived, to our knowledge. But the world is a really complex place. So actually working out what, you know, the best way you can do good is, or, you know, the best way you can apply yourself to produce good outcomes is a really difficult thing to work out. And then because as I said, we have a constraint on our emotions as well, it's an even harder thing to actually follow through and do.
I think you
have to generate some kind of philosophy of life, I think, that takes into account those two constraints. You need to think of some way of living that means you can, you know, do a reasonable amount of good if you think doing good is what you should do.
But apply it more in a practical sense.
Yeah, exactly.
More achievable.
Yeah, because I could say to myself tomorrow, right, tomorrow I'm going to do as much like good as I possibly can. But, you know, what does that actually tell me? Like, what does that tell me to do? I have no idea. And will I actually be able to do it? I don't know.
Okay.
So I think that's probably the big question in my head at the moment is what ways can I sort of apply myself on a day-to-day basis?
So your football coaching then?
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, your motivations are for that are more on the scale of the self-interest, correct?
That's
and
correct.
Not to say that that is in any way a bad thing, because like we said earlier, the majority of the things we do are motivated by that, right? But surely there must be ways to incorporate that philosophy of doing good in that sense. What kind of aspects of football coaching would be able to apply to that, do you think?
I definitely think people really like playing football. People like football, so at the very least, I think the people you're playing, if you do a good job of coaching, they'll get to play better, they'll get to play in a more sort of coherent way as a team. And I think at the very least, there's some gains to be made there. So not sure they're that big, but at least it's something. But yeah, as you suggested, my main motive is self-interested. As I think it is with most things I do, possibly all things unbeknownst to like myself. Mm. Like, you know, it could be that the only reason I want to do good is to have a sense of meaning in my life, and that's that might be the main reason I do it, and I could be unaware of it or not fully cognizant of it. So I think at least a thing I want to do in my life is to, you know, donate reasonable sums of the amount I earn to charity. That's like, you know, that's sort of my bare minimum ethical requirement. Like,
how is that going to work then? Do you plan to monthly
undecided
donate?
So yeah,
or you know, when you get to a certain amount of earnings, are you going to donate a proportion of that, or how's that?
Yeah, I'm undecided on that. So at the moment, because I think you've got a lot of things to weigh up, because it might be that, because generally speaking, you know, people's quality of lives across the globe are increasing over time, right? You know, humans are living better, like on average, humans are living better lives as time goes on. You know, poorer areas are getting less poor. In which case, it might be better to, say, invest money now in the well-being of those people, as in you give money now.
Okay.
But it's
because
also...
you can have a bigger
impact. Yeah, because you can have a bigger impact when people are less well-off per pound, something like that.
Yes.
Because, you know, the way I would donate money would be, what do I think is the biggest impact I can have, biggest positive impact I can give on someone's life per pound? Again, I'm quite mechanical about the way I apply. Yeah.
And that,
morality.
Again, is probably quite subjective, right?
Yeah.
Or do you think there are objective aspects?
I think there
are,
you know, there are fairly objective things. Like, if you know you can save a life, that's pretty objective.
True, yeah.
There are subjective things. Like, you could say, is alleviating a certain disease better than... I can't think of another example.
Like toileting, you know, sanitation.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah,
preventing
disease,
that comes
down
maybe.
To, yeah.
Maybe, you know, feeding people.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, sure. So you definitely have those subjective differences on some level. I mean, maybe it's like if you had more information, you could discern whether preventing water diseases, you know, will cause more good than... you know, developing a vaccine for something else, you could go, well, maybe per pound, which of these is actually helping more lives? But yeah, given, you know, the way we think about these things and what we know, it's definitely subjective on some level. But there's a level of objectivity, right? Like, I don't mean to be inflammatory, but like if I, you know, if I donate to something like a mosquito net, right, which has probably a very high amount of, like, lives saved per pound, that's probably a much better investment than if I were to invest it in, I don't know, I don't mean to pick on any charity, but you can probably think of a charity that you can imagine doesn't do that much good. You know, probably one in a developed country, like, just by the fact it's in a developed country where the currency is worth much more, you're just going to do less per pound for the fact that the currency
where people are more well off anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if people are living in squalid conditions, on, you know, little to no food each day, and they have no toilet and no income, and where there are charities in this country which support people who live in housing and have incomes and things like that.
Yeah.
Like you say, you know, I come from the same philosophy that there's, you know, there's no such thing as, well, charity is there to do good normally, right?
Yeah.
But like you say, there are probably objectively better charities than others.
Yeah.
And I think I do vibe with you on the same thing that, you know, saving a life is probably better. So I think in times gone past, you know, one of the ones that stands out to me is the Medics Without Borders, because that's fairly close to my heart in terms of being in healthcare, I think.
Yeah.
Especially in such a developed country where our healthcare is so fantastic.
Yeah.
To think that there are countries out there where people have no access to healthcare is quite shocking to me. But
yeah,
go on. Sorry, you were saying earlier about your, you know, your choice in the matter of how you donate that money.
Yeah. I think it's just because you have I'm getting like kind of probably boringly technical, but like you have the trade-off of, I can probably do more good now if I mess with my money, given that life outcomes getting better. Then you also have the trade-off of, I can invest my money, and therefore that money will make more money for itself, probably.
And then
you know, like, that's more money, and therefore you can do more good. So
yeah.
I'd have to look into the technicalities of something like the rate at which the amount of good I can do per pound, the increase of that versus the increase generated by investing money. But that's a really boring question.
Well, there is something interesting about that, because I've thought about it in the same sense that, you know, I can spend my money on charity now.
Yeah.
And actually, I wouldn't be left with very much. But like you're saying, there's almost a logical benefit to me, or a moral benefit to me being richer.
Yeah.
Because I can then donate more money.
Yeah.
So should you invest your time therefore in being getting richer, so
yeah,
you have more money to invest, or
You can definitely make, yeah. I did consider that for a time, but like, again, I think, you know, I could take a job and try to make as much money as I could and invest it, but I think then I talked about sort of the constraints, I think, which you have on humans in doing good, and for me that would come under like my constraint on emotion. Like, I wouldn't want to do that. And even though might feel that was a really actually morally good way to spend my time, I just don't think I could do it. Like, I'm not an especially sort of driven person, financially at least. I'm motivated much more by the intrinsic enjoyment I get from things. You know, right or wrong, that's what motivates me. Things like creativity and actual just intrinsic enjoyment of an activity. Yeah. So yeah, I don't think I could do that, but you could make a strong moral case for why that was like a good thing to do.
That's brilliant. I'm really impressed with how much thought you put into everything, and you're by far one of the most philosophical people
I've met
or spoken to. Whether is that maybe because you spend a lot of time thinking about these things, or just because that's the way your brain works?
Both. Like, because, you know, the main reason I think about these things is because I find them interesting. Again, that's really at core what motivates me. It's like, I think part of it's interesting because it informs the way you live your life, and that's important. But the main reason I think about it is because I find it fun to think about. Like, rather than me thinking, you know, being morally driven to do the right thing.
It all seems to tie up in a strange way to me.
Yeah.
Speaking with you now, in the sense that right at the beginning of the podcast we were talking about the maths and what motivated you to go into that, and it was very much because you enjoy logic and the problem solving aspect of those types of things. Correct me if I'm wrong, but then I'm sure that translates very much into the way you perceive philosophy and ethics and morals, in the fact that you take a very pragmatic and logical approach to them. Like you say, it's not just about your opinions, it's then how much objective good you can do. And I think that's really inspiring, really. And it's really interesting to listen to you talk about it, because it actually gives you food for thought in terms of challenging your own way of thinking and actually challenging what your actions are to figure out a better way of doing things myself, right?
Yeah.
Or for the listener.
Well, so I'd like to hear about you then. Like, what's your approach? Well, I don't know where to start with that, but sort of on anything that I've said about. So how would you approach your life generally then?
So
given that this is a topic I'm really unsure on, because for me, I do have the big problem of, you know, I think logically it's really important to do good, and I can't really justify that not being the main aim of life, but find that nearly impossible to do. What would you say you do?
I would say my main focus in life is to do good.
Yeah.
Like we were saying earlier. And I think it's because it's the only way I can figure out that my life has any meaning at all.
Yeah. Well, I spoke about that earlier.
And it's very scary thinking about what meaning life has. And really, I can't really come up with a good enough answer to that.
Yeah.
And it's generally depressing to try and figure out.
Yeah.
And come to a conclusion that my life probably doesn't have any meaning at all.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. There's no intrinsic meaning.
There is no answer to why are we here.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
In my mind. So, bearing that in mind, there is no reason why we are here in the first place. I may as well, at least while I'm on this planet, do good for other people, right? Because I can't figure out any other way to justify my existence and to live a good life, right?
Yeah.
I think that's the definition for me, is living a good life is doing good for others.
Yeah.
That's been hard at times, because you then look at your life at times when maybe you're struggling with mental health, or maybe I've been particularly unmotivated at times. Like for instance, take a weekend or something where I've just been really tired at the end of the week. I didn't have much planned, and I maybe wasted it by spending loads of time lying in bed. I went out and partied and things like that. And you're thinking, well, what good has that done? So it's definitely not the most helpful way of living all of the time.
Yeah.
But I think generally speaking, it's probably the conclusion I've come to in terms of how to live life, really. And that's kind of why I've gone down the route of veganism. That's why I've gone down the route of physiotherapy. And it's probably informed a lot of my other life choices too. But, you know, that's very personal, and that doesn't mean that someone else's motivations in life are wrong. And, you know, I think that's probably the conclusion I've come to, really, is it's just, there is no right or wrong way in life. It's just what's best for me. And that's what I've decided, I think.
Yeah. It's a funny phrasing at the end of that, though, saying, you know, it's just what's right for me. Like, because in a weird way, that kind of runs contrary to the whole thing. As in, it sounds like I'm nitpicking. I'm trying not to. And I'm, again, not trying to argue. I'm just trying to raise a point that there's something funny about the fact it's rounded off with saying that, you know, it's best for me when the entire thing was about it's doing what's best for others. I think that's very much the problem of, you know, at the end of the day, you need to do the good, and if you can't find a way to do the good, you won't do the good, and you probably won't do the good if you're not motivated to do the good. And then, you know, it's again kind of about the person actually doing it.
I think it's quite a nice way to round off the conversation. Yeah. Actually, I think it sort of brought us around full circles and kind of touches on the tribalism, things like that, we talked about earlier, and the whole aspect of football and the coaching and stuff. And this conversation's been particularly good food for thought for me, and I really thrive on conversations like this where we're, you know, really going into philosophical topics that I, you know, you can really delve deep into and go in all sorts of directions. Because I like thinking about these things, and probably like yourself, I like sitting down to myself and actually, you know, trying to figure out what the answers are to these, bearing in mind that they're often
there usually isn't one.
So thank you for coming on today's episode and
bringing
thanks such a philosophical mindset to the whole thing. It's definitely been beneficial for me, and I've really enjoyed it, and it's been so good to catch up as well, because like we said at the beginning, it's been a long time since I've even spoken to you or seen you. So thank you for coming on.
No props.
Thank you, Will, for recording, and thank you for everyone for listening, and I hope you enjoyed, and we'll see you on the next episode. Take care.